This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this podcast. I'm Helen Needham. In this edition, I take a wander up a hill I'd never really noticed before in Aberdeenshire. Barra Hill, near Old Meldrum, was introduced to me through the writing of Ian Gross, which I came across in the literary journal Echtry. Ian writes compellingly and in great detail about this place. He reveals layer upon layer of human history, and that really prompts us to think about how we view and perceive landscapes when we exist within them, and that there are ways of connecting with the hidden layers of history, which can be both moving and enlightening. We began our walk towards the ancient hill fort of Barra Hill in the village of Old Meldrum.
When I first started looking into the hill, I was curious about the name of Old Meldrum and where that comes from. And I found out that Meldrum is from the old Gaelic Mealdroma or Mealdrim, depending whether it's Irish or Old Scottish Gaelic. And that means ridge of the hill, which must be Barra Hill. And the old comes from the Gaelic Alt, which means a burn or stream. So the name of the village, Old Meldrum, the literal translation of it is the burn of the ridge of the hill. The name of the village actually comes out of the landscape where it's situated in the landscape. And that to me was a little light bulb moment, you know, because the identity of the village with its name comes out of the landscape. I looked into the name of the local landowners, who were also called Meldrum, originally thinking that the name of the place was named after the Meldrum family, who were situated in Meldrum House. But it's the other way around. So originally it was granted to a guy called Philip de Fendarg in 1266, when it was made a barony, an ancient borough. And they then, the family, subsequently changed the name from de Fendarg to de Meldrum. So they took on the name of the place that they'd become landowners of. So their identity as a family also comes out of the landscape. And all the people that would have lived around the settlement would have identified with that, with the big house and the big family, and their identity would have been associated with it. So the identity of the whole village and all its people and the original landowners here all comes out of the situation of this burn by the ridge of the hill.
Which is astonishing, really, and probably something that you would find all around Scotland as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't know about that, but when you look into it in the wider area, that seems a common theme. So especially in Gaelic place names, they often refer physically to geographical features in the landscape. You know?
The other thing is that people wouldn't necessarily associate Gaelic place names with Aberdeenshire either, in the northeast of Scotland.
No. I mean, it largely disappeared by the 13th century, but remained in pockets. Strathdon's got some remnant pockets of Gaelic communities right up until the 19th century. And down towards Stonehaven as well, but it had largely disappeared, yeah, from the landscape.
But yet the names remain.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there's still this echo of the people that went before held in the land through place names.
And how do you go about discovering all of this then?
Well, the internet's a good thing. But, you know, I read a lot of books about landscape around place names, referencing other researchers like William Nicolaysen. He was a big place name researcher, and a guy called Adam Watson.
Oh, yes, Adam Watson, the legend.
Yes, absolutely. I visit places, I pick up on other features that might be worth looking into, and then I use the internet to build on that context.
Well, we're just coming to a signpost, and this is the Barrow Hill Community Path.
I like the change in atmosphere here, because we've come away from the busy road, come up by the burn, and then when we reach the woods, everything just becomes a bit more still, and you hear the crows and the trees and the calls of birds. And if your head is full of all this history and time, like mine's been, and there's an amazing confluence of history here. There's a Pictish presence, which we'll talk about. The hill itself is an Iron Age fort, and there's all the local history and the castles and things. If you're thinking about that, then that generates an atmosphere, I think. And to me, when I walk up here on my own, that stillness starts to open up the time, if you like.
And when you're walking through here alone, and you've got all these bits of history flying around your head, what are you thinking of?
I mean, the footpath itself has been used for hundreds of years, at least since the end of the 18th century, because the minister used to walk between Meldrum and Bawtie, because he'd do services in each of the kirks. And so when I'm walking along this trail over the hill, I'm thinking about all the other feet that have gone before me and all the people that have gone before me, which, if you're aware of that, is like a silent memory, you know, that's sort of locked into the land. And it brings an added reverence, I think, to the landscape and to your place within it. And you realise you're part of a much bigger story. It's not just here and now. I mean, here and now is great, you know, mindfulness and everything, but thinking about your own life in context to a much bigger story, I think, is a good thing. But it can also be a bit disorientating, I suppose, if you think about it too much, you know.
Yeah, well, I feel moved already, and there's established trees here, a mixture of beech and oaks and pines, and lots of roots like claws, and we've got the burn down to our right, just chattering away there, and then I think that's jackdaws possibly above us.
I think as well about the amount of time that burn has been flowing, which is at least hundreds of years. I don't know if it's been diverted by farmers over time, but you know, in the Flover River or the Flover Burn, that reminds you of the flow of time, doesn't it?
The other thing, when you were talking about imagining all the footsteps and all the people that have walked this way for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and I think about all their thoughts.
Yeah, and they were people just like us, so I think that's what's poignant about it. Would have had the very similar emotions, would have felt loss. They obviously did have attachment to place. And it's that sense of the human story, I think, that you can find in the land that I think is, for me, it's a magnetic draw, because it speaks of the human condition.
Tell me a bit about yourself then, because you're doing a PhD at the minute at Aberdeen University, but this is not something you've always been doing.
No, I was a pilot for 20 plus years before that, a helicopter pilot. And I had a sense, actually, probably 10 years ago or more, that I wanted to perhaps do something else.
And as a pilot then, a helicopter pilot, you had literally a bird's eye view of the earth. Do you think that informed your perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, I spent an awful lot of time flying over the sea.
Yeah, okay.
But growing up, I just wanted to be a pilot because it seemed like a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
And then you enjoy the sensation of flying, I mean, the air. But once you get used to that, you're left with the view, really.
Yeah.
Apart from the job, the work.
Yes, actually doing what you've got to do.
Yeah, when you have the odd moment to look out the window. It was the landscape that always drew my gaze, and I started to feel quite disconnected from the landscape, from the land, from life on the ground, I think. And I felt I needed to connect with more people and also find out more about the landscape and how it shapes us. And so, you know, literally was looking to be, you know, more grounded.
And then you actually started to suffer from vertigo.
Yeah, in the end, I think I did the job for a bit too long. And I'd taken a new job as an air ambulance pilot down in Perth. And I just had this increasing sense of tension every time I was flying.
Right.
And eventually it manifested as the beginnings of vertigo. You know, I managed to nip it in the bud, luckily.
Yeah.
Because it's not a great thing. I mean, vertigo if you're a pilot. And so I lost my medical. But then luckily I was offered a funded PhD. And so I took that and here I am. And again, the hill at that time was part of a sort of personal process to understand, you know, who I might be now, what I might do, where it is I belonged, all that kind of stuff.
So it's played such a significant role in your life.
It gave me the space to think and to redirect my attention into other things. But I realised it was that question of where it is we belong, where do I belong? That was part of it, you know, part of the story of the landscape.
And this was the grounding hill for you, really?
It was, yeah. It was, and so the project I'm working on is basically it's a book, and that's called Groundings, which is a series of explorations into the landscape, to the way it shapes me, and also the way it shapes other people that I talk to, and the way it shaped us historically, you know.
Well, we're just striding up a grassy field just now, up the hill, so
yeah,
excuse the deep breathing. There's actually quite a lot of rocks around here. There's lots of the piles of rocks, which have obviously been cleared from the land.
But the occupation on the hill goes back probably to the end of the last ice age. There's a found Mesolithic flints, axe heads, arrowheads from later. I think as the climate changed around 1800 BC, it got cooler and wetter, and that seemed to prompt this sudden building of hill forts.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Just stop a moment. You've got Barry Hill here, Benny Heath to the left, which Mither Tap, that's a Pictish fort. Tappanoth, known to be the largest Pictish hill fort, or the largest hill fort of its kind in Europe.
Wow, really?
And Riney, the village of Riney, just beneath it. That name comes from a Pictish word or Brythonic word, Rigonin. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but it means the place of a king. And Gordon Noble, who is heading up the archaeology team from the University of Aberdeen, he's uncovered glass vessels from France, residue of Mediterranean wine, metalwork production.
Wow, so, it's astonishing.
So that hill over there, very prominent point on it. It was once, you know, a royal centre that had connections with the rest of the world.
That's the thing that's so fascinating, isn't it? Because now you would never know, would you? Well, it feels like we're actually
not far
on the fort proper now. Well,
these are the walls, so you can see there's a series of defences, and they were built in three phases, I think, between the Late Bronze Age through the Iron Age. And again, there's been a lot of soil filled in the gaps, so they're only, what, 2 or 3 feet high now?
Yeah.
But back in the heyday, there would have been perhaps 9 or 12 feet trenches with, again, these wooden palisades a very difficult fort to take. It was very defensive. Why it became that way, it seems that we don't know. It's probably population growth and climate pressure.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing today. And if you think about it, today we're also becoming sort of, you know, a bit more ill-thought in thinking in terms of nations. All the old links are breaking down, and you wonder if it's just history repeating itself on a huge scale, you know. So we'll just nip through here and...
Okay.
So that big stone at the very centre, that's the Wallace's putting stone.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So in legend, William Wallace, with his big muscles, threw it from the summit of Ben Hee over there.
Right. How far is Ben Hee?
In a fit of rage, you know. But again, this is another feature in the landscape that we can't help but attach story to, you know.
We
have to explain things.
A human need.
Yeah. And the explanation for this stone that's sitting more or less on its own is attached to events in history.
Mm-hmm.
You can start to see now, can't you, the open enclosure and the wall surrounding it, 360 degrees of wall.
Yeah, it's actually a much bigger area at the top
flat
than I imagined, really flat.
And there would have been different huts, and kids playing, and people cooking, people mending and making. And it would have been a busy, thriving community within the safety of the walls.
I'm just looking over towards Ben Hee, which is, it's almost like a shadow at the moment just because we've got low cloud and it's kind of looming over there in the west. And then we've got these sun rays peeping through the cloud as if they're spotlights shining down on Inverurie over there. And it's quite an aspect we've got the way around us, so, really.
Yeah, it's a panorama, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's the old village of Meldrum. Its centre dates to the sort of 17th century. Late 1600s, Barra Castle is down here, out of view on this western side. And where the Lochter fishery is now, they were the Lochter marshes, and that's basically, roughly, where the Battle of Barra took place in 1308 with Robert the Bruce against his rival John Comyn. Not John Comyn that he murdered in Dumfries before, it was his cousin. And he came up here from Inverness to face his final sort of rival for the crown. John Comyn's forces, they all bottled it and ran. But then Bruce commanded his brother Edward to sack the whole region. It was part of Buchan then. And raise any houses that were loyal to Comyn. And it was a big atrocity. And it became known as the harrying or hership of Buchan. And there's a stone down in the village, which I didn't point out as we were coming up just by the roundabout. And that's known as Bruce's Seat, because it's a seat-shaped boulder, which was once somewhere on this hill. And he was supposed to have commanded the battle because he was too ill to take part. He apparently had leprosy. But again, I think it's just another feature in the landscape that we attach story to remember.
And how do you learn about these stories other than the internet? Is there a sense of sharing through oral history as well? Do people around here know this stuff? Or are you just a geek?
Yeah, I think I'm just a geek. I mean, that story would have been passed down through the oral record for sure. It's an oral history. And then at some point, you know, somebody writes them down. The main record for that battle is in John Barber's rhyming narrative. It's a big, long, epic poem called The Bruce, or De Bruce. And he describes what happens at the battle and what happened afterwards. But it's very much biased towards Bruce. Wherever you look in the landscape, there'll be a story or a history that is largely forgotten in the public imagination, but it's still there to be found. And I think once you start uncovering that, it becomes quite compelling, you know, it draws you further in. And this stone over here is called the Minister's Rest. So on his way to the Kirk in Borty, just on the other side of the hill, he would have stopped here to take in the view and have a rest.
Not a bad spot.
Yeah, not a bad spot at all. If you look down there, you can see the Kirk's in a Borty stone circle.
Oh, yeah.
Which is on a hill. And that, likewise, has an almost panoramic view of the landscape. And you get a sense that that location is in conversation with the landscape when you stand over there with Ben Hee, with this hill, perhaps even with Tappernoth. There's more stone circles down in Daviot, the Sheldon Stone Circle, which is over there. That was built 1,000 years later than that. So the area has had this resonance of the people who've lived here for a long time.
1,000 years later?
Yeah, so it's an ancient stone circle, as is that. But there's about 1,000 years that separates them.
Gosh, I hadn't realised it was such a long time span.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
that they were in use.
That's 5,000 or 6,000 years it's been sat there. And Sheldon Stone's probably 4 or 5. And there's a shift in what they thought was important. So that has a recumbent stone, which aligns with the southern moon and the 18-year cycle of the standstill mill, where it rises and sets in the same position in the sky every 18 years, which was, for some reason, an important event for the Neolithic people who built all the recumbent stone circles. See, it acts as a false horizon, so it's lying horizontally between two upright stones, and it charts the movement of the southern moon that way. But when Sheldon Stone Circle was built, there are two stones there that align with the sunrise of Beltane and Imbolc, which are really old Celtic festivals, sometimes still celebrated today. And so there's no recumbent stone, so there's a shift in importance for some reason between the standstill moon and perhaps Beltane and Imbolc and those times of year. Perhaps as they had got more into the agricultural way of life. So it signalled, Beltane signals when you move the cattle to summer pastures for grazing, and signals the coming of spring and renewal. And so there's a definite shift in cosmology there, evident in the stones.
And this is still very much an agricultural area, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's another reason why it has a lot of resonance for me, because you see the tractor in the fields over there, not far from the Kirtan Aborti Stone Circle, and you realise just how long this land has been farmed, and that where we stand right now, you and I in this moment, is just the crest of a very big wave that started 6,000-8,000 years ago. And still continues today.
And thinking along those lines, it just makes you respect the land in a way for giving so much for all this time, giving
yeah,
so much to us.
It's amazing that it still does, actually.
Yeah.
I also think when you come to understand landscape in this way, you know, you get a sense of ownership and belonging, and that applies to anybody, you know. So it's not about some sort of story of ancestry and hereditary belonging, because the Caledoni, who were the precursors to the Picts, then the Picts and the Romans came, and then the Gaels came from Ireland, then the Normans came, there was people from Frisia who established farms here. So it's a continually evolving story, places and continual change with new people coming and going all the time. So there can be a danger in looking at landscape and getting locked into this idea of ancestry and belonging in that way, which is a dangerous focus, I think.
Why do you think it's dangerous?
Because as soon as you do that, you can easily start to think about who might not belong. There's outsiders and insiders, and that's historically is not a good way to go.
Yeah, so you're more of we're all the earth's children, as it were.
Kind of. Well, more that place is a product of all places, really, and that it's under this influence of even back in the Picts' day, it was a much wider influence than, you know, a global influence. You think about Tapa North, and they were trading with people in the Mediterranean. So this idea that people are rooted and contained by one place is wrong, and all places are products of continual change. And so it's important to get a sense of belonging in a landscape, and understanding and appreciating a landscape helps to bring that, but it's not confined to any particular group.
And I suppose that also brings around questions of ownership as well, actually.
Yeah, territory, ownership, land use.
Standing here, though, on this hill, which I'd never noticed before, it feels like this is a place of significance.
Absolutely.
It's timeless, really, that people have been coming here, inhabiting this place, living from this place for thousands of years, and I feel a little kind of shiver in the belly there, actually, just stopping to contemplate that.
There's definitely an atmosphere that you pick up on when I've come here on my own, and when it's like this, it's very still and quiet. Mm. You know, you lose your sense of time. You sit and contemplate, the time that you're in disappears, and the time between you and the people of the past collapses, can collapse or feel like it collapses. And then you can really begin to see or imagine that, you know, the Pictish people or the Iron Age people that would have lived and worked in this enclosure and in this landscape. And when I was going through that process of, you know, coming to terms with the loss of a career and things like that through suffering from vertigo, I did get a similar feeling on the hill one day. It was completely shrouded in mist, and the sun just burned through the mist, and it felt as though the hill was kind of suspended in space, and I got that sense of vertigo. But it was through the sense of time, I think, the timelessness, that gave me that sense, rather than a loss of balance, if you know what I mean.
It feels like the kind of place that actually you just want to spend time in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like compelled to
move on.
Yes.
No, yeah, you just want to sit and and be for a while.
And it's interesting that you talked earlier about the place name being completely influenced by the hill, and it has obviously been significant and had some kind of energy draw for people for so long.
Mm-hmm. High ground would have been a draw for the people then, because there would have been a much more extensive tree cover, and any high ground gives you that perspective, that view of the wider landscape, and you can watch for predators, you can watch for game, you can keep an eye out for other groups that are passing through. If they'd started to think about territory then, we don't know, but they might have already started to think about, this is our hill, you know, this is where we are, and looking out for other groups to trade with, perhaps, to trade with and talk to, rather than just fight with, who knows?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because it is not a very heavily treed landscape anymore.
It's completely agricultural.
It's a patchwork of pasture and cultivated land, lots of newly sown fields around, and we've even got a couple of fields of polytunnels as well, but there's just patches of plantation. So just actually trying to imagine the trees within this landscape, and then you look beyond to the hills, and it starts to make a bit more sense.
All of landscape for me is narrative. You can almost peel back the layers as you're looking at it. Inverurie there, how it's grown over the years, and the road, and before that the glacier retreating up this way towards the Cabrach, helping to shape Benahee and the hills, and it's just this long, long story. And I think part of the draw is that there's a lot of loss in that story. There's countless generations of people that have all wondered and dreamed and loved and thought. And it's a bit melancholy, but I think that's part of the poignancy of the traces that are left in the landscape, you know.
Thanks very much to Ian Gross for taking me up Barrow Hill in Aberdeenshire. It was just so illuminating spending time tuning into the history of that place. And the music in that piece is called The Unknown, and it's by another chap who loves landscapes, Barry Reed, and his album Breathing Spaces. Please do get in touch with us and tell us where you listen to this podcast. We love hearing from you. You can email the team at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. I'm Helen Needham. Thanks for listening.